The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Welcome to The Lawyer's Edge, a program that seeks to answer your questions on civil, criminal, constitutional, and political legal matters with attorneys Robert J. Slama and David Trotty. Robert J. Slama is a U.S. veteran and prominent attorney who has served as counsel for some of Jacksonville's most high-profile cases. Robert Slama is a member of the Florida Bar and the U.S. Supreme Court Bar Associations. He's argued cases in Florida, as well as constitutional cases, before the highest court in the land. David Trotty is a Florida Bar attorney, practicing since 2000, and is a certified civil and family law mediator and a qualified arbitrator in the state of Florida. His practice focuses on family and criminal law issues and mediation. He's a former Marine who served in Japan and the U.S. Embassy in Austria and Tanzania. Also a federal police officer with the Central Intelligence Agency. It's now time to discuss today's legal topics and issues and how they impact your family and small business. Now, live from the WBOB studios, here's attorneys Robert J. Slama and David Trotty.
Good afternoon, Jacksonville, and welcome to another edition of The Lawyer's Edge. I'm in the studio today with, of course, Roger Henderson and David Trotty, and I have in my hand a Maggiano's gift certificate right here.
Nice. I've only been there twice in my whole life.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
You got to get out more, Roger.
One of the two times I was there, I ran into you. Remember that?
I remember the one. That was about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Were you with the relatives? Your wife?
Yeah, wife and daughter, I think. Time.
It was during Christmas, I think. You were out Christmas shopping and you looked, there was a birthday or something.
Right.
Right? Right.
It is a great place.
Isn't it great? In fact, it's a $50 gift certificate for dinner.
Okay.
For call in at 222-TALK, talk to David and I, and we have a gift certificate for you. So anyway, it's here. You can call us and we are ready to talk to you. David, listen. From last time, I want to ask you something because we were talking about mental illness. And when you get into this mental illness stuff, we hear about it, of course, when people get shot. And, you know, these things come up in the context of some extreme event, right? But you and I on a daily basis, and this is why I say this is such an important topic. Mental illness is something, let's get real, no one wants to deal with. The people who are dealing with it, family members. It is a very difficult issue to deal with. That ranges because there's so many different levels from what I call general anxiety, people taking Xanax and pills for different types of stress, some related to not depression, but anxiety. So the first thing a doctor may do is prescribe and say, you've been stressed out. Roger's stressed out at work. He's working 30 hours a day. In 24 hours, and he's trying to figure it, which is true in his case. I'm sorry, didn't mean.
Thank you.
No problem. And, you know, you're dealing with that. Others have different things. Shorter depression is my point.
Right, but it's all mental illness under a very broad umbrella.
Sure.
Some mental illness is not as severe as others, just like some physical illness isn't as severe.
Of course.
Okay.
And I wanted to make this clear because I didn't want anyone to think that what I was saying before, as we're hearing today in the news, that if you have any degree of mental illness, it means you're violent. In fact, that's not the case. However, under stress, people do different things under stress. Now, I can only speak for myself. I've had in my practice in 26 years, I call it 3.5, almost 4 murder-suicides.
Wow.
Where I'm talking to someone like I'm talking to you, Roger, and I look at them and say, hey, have a nice day. I'll see you tomorrow. And then tomorrow I pick up the newspaper and their face is on the front end. And on mine were all pretty horrific. When I say the half.
Oh, no.
Do you remember the Jaguars cheerleader? Judge Merritt was the judge. I'm the one who got the restraining order against the son, against the her boyfriend. And ultimately, we know how that story ends. She almost made it the 6 months where there was no interaction. of a negative nature, and her family, she was living with her family. Her family went away for the weekend. He came up. She had a gate around it, came in through the gate. She was with the football player, Charles Osgood, who was from the San Diego Chargers. That whole episode, he went upstairs, and as you know the story, he came in with his gun, went upstairs, grabbed her by the hair, banged her head around, all that. The brave football player, as she left the room with this guy, put the chair up under the door, locked her out, and then he goes out a window and runs away. And then when she's downstairs, he fires at her, she fires at him. They both miss each other. Now, here's the story. They were high school sweethearts. Afterwards, he was smoking marijuana, and he wasn't really doing a whole lot of stuff. This young man, by the way, is the son of a very prominent person from the city of Jacksonville, who's into bodybuilding and such. Let's just say that. And that never really got into the news, which is fine. But it was this. You don't think of episodes such as that, which is, because here is what I'm kind of laying out, because it's all in the public record. Everything I'm telling you is in the public record. A young man, he's smoking marijuana. He doesn't really have any desire. He's got this beautiful girlfriend. She becomes a cheerleader. She's kind of moving on. He's not really in the picture. He doesn't have much ambition. Next thing you know, she's seeing a football player. He's stalking her, following her, shows up one night, and the situation becomes violent. Now, there was an episode that happened before that, which is why I got the injunction, which I won't go on. I won't get into on the radio, but I will say this, that his efforts to follow her were changing. And almost like this case that we hear down south in Parkland, there were so many different warning signs that he was coming unglued and that he was potentially moving towards violence, not just to himself, but potentially to a third party. It was all there. In fact, David, when I was in the courtroom with Judge Merritt, and this I can tell you, he was sitting in the back. I come in. He had passed the case, so I was out handling some other cases. I came back, and this was towards the end of the calendar, so the courtroom was thin. When he sees me, he grabs his eye, reaches underneath it like I'm doing, pulls his eye, and then he's winking at me. I looked at Merritt. I said, Judge, this is what this young man just did. I think he might be threatening me, and I'm the wrong person to threaten. He said, well, I'm confident, he threatens you, you take care of it. I'm like, yes, sir, I most certainly will. But bizarre behavior. This isn't normal behavior that most people do. And I don't know him, so I don't know how to gauge that behavior. So what am I saying? This doesn't sound like a very violent guy. Yet, I know how the story ends. And I think of this case because of the other ones I've had. You think you see where the violence is coming from and that the violence is necessarily going to follow from a number of events. Here's my point. It's only by putting it together. It's only by putting it together in a whole picture, all the pieces coming together, you see a pattern of behavior, and the pattern of behavior is leading somewhere. Now, in light of what I just said, mental illness, you do family law as well as I do. We're dealing in family law cases, situations every single day. You and I are mandatory reporters. If we believe that there's threats, we have to take action. Now, I threw you a scenario. As we come back, we're going to kind of process this. But David, what I'm curious is, everyone out there, as I just told a story, there's 1,000 people right now that have their own story or what they're dealing with, trying to figure out what to do, how they manage it, and then how do you manage it as you're going through a divorce. Call us. We're here for you on A Lawyer's Edge. 222-TALK. It's 222-TALK. We got a Maggiano's gift certificate. Call us, and we are here for you.
A law firm dedicated to helping families. A law firm dedicated to you. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
Hi, I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. For over 17 years, I've assisted the Jacksonville community by providing a full-service law firm for families, not the rich and powerful, but for everyday families like yours. Since 1998, I have handled some of the most complicated cases in Jacksonville, including
Brenton Butler, and more recently the jury verdict in Jermaine DeBose. Whether it's family law, including divorce, custody, or bankruptcy, juvenile law, personal injury, probate, civil rights, or not-for-profit and churches, I'm dedicated to helping your family with your legal needs. I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. Call me anytime. My number is 904-296-1050, or you may text me at 838-8607. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
Welcome back to The Lawyer's Edge with Robert J. Slama and David Trotty, talking about the law today, and specifically with respect to things that are going on in the news today, mental illness and how it can affect crime and encourage crime, I would suppose.
Well, no, the point I was trying to make was in the context. No, I don't mean crime in general. I mean, now, let's
personal safety.
Personal safety and taking, say, in a family law case. Here you are, you're a litigant, you come in, and you notice... How many times, David, would you say when you start and you're inventorying your client or the client's spouse, how often would you say that mental health issues are a part of that case, either with a child, the person you represent, or the spouse?
100%.
Okay, that's a little bit higher than I would have said.
100%.
Why do you say 100%?
I think every case, you as an attorney, when you're assessing it, have to look at what you're being told, what's not being told with your prospective client, the unknown effects of the children on with divorce and a separation, and what you have no clue of with the other side. So when I'm initially assessing, there is a impact of mental health to that case.
Somewhere.
More likely... It's going to fall down and rainfall down to the children. The parents are at each other's throats. Typically, we have good parents, and they're in a terrible situation. Because they're in a terrible situation, they're at each other's throats, and that's going to have a negative impact on the children, whether one is taking the children away from the other parent or keeping or shielding. That is going to have a negative mental impact on the children. So I say... 100% of our family law cases has the mental impact, mental welfare impact that we need to assess.
Oh, no, now I understand the context in which you're saying that, and I agree with that. I guess here's what I mean in terms of, like, how many of your cases would you say also involve alcohol, drugs, substance abuse, some sort of addictive behaviors?
100%.
See? So now, think about this. Someone's trying to go through a divorce, and we know it's already stressful, right?
Already.
Unsettling.
Already.
You don't know what's going to happen to your finances, your retirement, the dog, the pets.
No clue, and we as attorneys hold the key to the courthouse, meaning we're going to start that action, and how we advise our clients on how to start that action in the court is going to have either a positive impact or a detrimental impact on that family. And we need to heed and take caution of that situation. And we talked about it several, I think a month or two ago, about when we consult our clients, taking a mental inventory of the mental health of the clients, the family, and the children. Because we don't want to exasperate, right?
Or leave untreated.
Or leave untreated, but as an attorney, I'm not a treating physician.
But we manage it. In other words, managing it, and this is why I wanted to get to this point. When you say, as you have, I'm not a mental health professional.
We gotta be careful of pushing buttons.
No.
Because we manage, but we have to be careful how we manage that case. I think too many of us attorneys manage in an inefficient way, which causes more harm to the family than not.
I agree with you 100% on that. I mean, those folks I call assassins. They're paid assassins. Someone pays them to come in and be a wrecking ball. What I meant by management was helping the client manage the mental health. So, for example.
How many of your clients have you said, you know, I think before we start this case, I want you to go get an assessment? Before you file a case for your potential client, do you say, you know what, I think you are unstable, and I think you need to go get a self-assessment, go get a hair follicle. I'm going to tell you what, I know what your number is, zero.
No, that's incorrect.
I'm not trying to, this is a serious situation with family law clients, is we go out there as attorneys and we beat our chest and we claw the trees and everything and we say the other person is the crazy one. The other person is a detrimental impact to the children, but we don't do the assessment of what the effect we're having on the case.
I just had a client, Baker acted last week. Okay, that's what I'm saying is, you if you followed me around, you would have a different opinion on that. This guy now is homeless. This guy, what he's gone through, and sends me a communication which indicates that he's struggling and he needs help. Now, that is the first time I've ever had anyone do that. In my career, I've Baker-acted three people, and him being the most recent last week. Two against their will. So to speak, in other words, when I say against their will, meaning it wasn't voluntary.
Right.
When I have someone come in, and I'm like you, when I'm looking at them, I have doctors, as you do, on my Rolodex, who when I see stuff and I'm not sure, I contact, say, Dr. Bloomfield.
Can I clarify something?
Sure.
I don't have a Rolodex anymore.
Your phone is the Rolodex. I'll get a hold of Steve, say, and say, Dr. Bloomfield, I'm seeing this. I'm hearing this. What do you think? I mean, in other words, is this benign that I don't need to worry about it? And so when I say management and management of the mental health issues, it may be on both sides. And it may be, I've had cases, the child, the mother and the father, they all had something going on. So all three of them need management. So from the very beginning, if I see any safety, health, wealth, what I call safety, health, welfare issues, I'm referring the children out if they don't already have someone that they're seeing and there's been any allegations of abuse or anything else.
Even if it's detrimental to your client's position?
Now when you say detrimental, listen to what I'm saying.
So you have an obligation of the Florida Bar to represent your client, and if you disclose to the courts or the other party something that's detrimental to your client's position, what do you do?
Now you see, but you made a jump, and I'm just gonna intervene between the jump that you made. I see someone who's there and there's a problem. They need help. My job managing, because I'm not a mental health professional, is to say to Mrs. Smith, I'm looking at the child. There's a problem here. I'm gonna recommend the child go see Mercedes McGowan. You, ma'am, because you've been abused, that's what I'm trying to get to, some of the different issues. You've been the subject of abuse. You may have also some addiction issues. Whatever it is, I'm referring you to this person, or this person. Now, I've made the referral. My professional responsibility I've satisfied. If they elect not to do it, I'm not the guardian. I'm not their guardian, their legal guardian. I make sure I identify. This is what I mean by management. Identify and refer. Once I identify and refer, I'm going to follow up with them.
So when you file a case and you have identified and referred your client, and let's just say for argument's sake, you represent the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And you recognize possible abuse that she's had in her childhood or under the hands of somebody. But now that she has been the victim, she has now gained addictive qualities, and she's addicted to painkillers,
yep,
alcohol or whatever, but it really hasn't been brought forth in the factual scenarios regarding the divorce. Now that you know this knowledge and you have identified and referred, do you have an obligation to divulge that information?
Hold on. Let's say you're on the other side.
I'm just asking you
no,
a question.
No, I understand. You're on the other side. My job is not to discover the case for you. Your job is, my job is to make sure that I'm handling her correctly.
So you file a petition saying my client's the abuser, Yep. And you're seeking an injunction against my client, but yet you have identified addictive qualities of your client, but yet you don't want to disclose the harmful effect those might have on the children.
Is there a John or Jane Doe clause that you can use and protect their identity and that kind of thing?
Well, no. I mean, what he's saying, now you're talking specifically about an injunction, but my point is, in terms of filing, these issues she has, typically, the other side already knows those issues are out there. To me, it's more important she's managing the behaviors, and it is related to the best interest of the child.
But let's see,
even if those come out,
but
they may.
But let's say, under your advice, because of the situation that she brought to your room,
yep,
you advise her to file a domestic violence injunction.
Well, but now we're getting into a separate whole thing, which is, but he's an abuser, and now she needs protection.
Or is she also an abuser?
But you're coming up with a scenario. Let's say the scenario is, he's continuing to abuse her. I realize he's abusing her, and the standard that there's an imminent threat of harm, and she has a subjective, reasonable fear that that's going to happen.
But yet she's addictive, and her addictive qualities are impacting the child negatively. So in that situation, what do you do?
Well, so I mean, if there's a risk to the child, if there is a risk to the child, a real risk to the child, I'm a mandatory reporter. I would have to disclose it. But it likely is not. It's that she's been abused, and as a result of the abuse, she's trying to deal with it, but she hasn't been met. What I find is, and this is where I was going with this, when do I think mental health illness becomes an issue, Roger, is when it's not being managed, and the people around them don't help the person manage it. So, like in this case, anyone having a situation where from a very low level to a very high level, if it's not being managed, is a problem. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Now, this is a real example again. I think I told you last time, the guy that was on the Matthews Bridge who jumped, I represented him, and he came back again in a criminal case later, but he was the one who jumped off the Matthews Bridge. I've dealt with this in a variety of contexts. Here's a real one. I have a guy that I represent, very nice young man, very nice. One day, and he had been bullied from when he was little, he was bullied, he was beaten by his brother, this kind of thing. Mom, very little, very nice, but she's getting in between two sons, and, you know, one's bigger and stronger, and the other one is littler and smaller and all that kind of stuff. Well, as a result of all of that, he also needed medication. He needed counseling, some other things. He went from being a juvenile to an adult, and he's a young adult. 6, 7, 8 months later, after he came out of the juvenile system, he had a problem in a Metro PCS. He goes into the store, has a problem. The guy was racial and a few other things to him. He comes out, grabs a gun, walks in the store. He's not threatening anyone in the usual sense. He comes in, just holds the gun up, facing up, and says, "See, I could have screwed you up." Walks around, turns around and walks out. Now, I defended that case for 4 years. Here's what I'm saying. Mental health managed, there was a period of time in a young person that it wasn't being managed. Had he been on meds, had he been in counseling, had he had the mentor, the assistance, and all that stuff, this event likely never happens. No one got hurt. There was no shooting. There was no intention to do so. But it was certainly not proper to come in a store with a gun to show someone.
Under Florida law, isn't that a felony?
Yeah, of course it's a felony.
Just showing the gun, brandishing.
That's what I went through a lot. It could have been 10-20 life. It could have been filed as, and under Florida law, ag assault, with a gun, it's 3-year min-man. But here's what my point is. Not the sentencing, it's this. Managed. How many people are walking around today under my voice that are sitting out there that are not managing mental health? I'm going to use the words here because you haven't heard it anywhere else. Unmanaged mental health is the threat and is the problem. But if it's managed, we're probably going to be okay as long as we're managing it. And where does it show up first? Classrooms, courtrooms, in front of attorneys, divorce cases, and juvenile. You're listening to The Lawyer's Edge. Give us a call.
We're back with The Lawyer's Edge with Robert J. Slom and David Trotty, attorneys at law, and making available a Maggiano's gift card worth $50 to enjoy a I guess, pretty good dinner there or lunch.
It sounds terrific, doesn't it?
It does sound terrific. And to qualify, Robert, how does one win that?
Just call David Trotty. Call us. Don't call David. Call us, and you'll go into the hat, and we'll let actually today we'll let Roger pick you out of the hat.
Okay.
Roger can pick, and you know what? I think what you all couldn't have seen this, but I think during the break, David just did a mic drop on me about a question we were debating. So let's pick up where he did the mic drop, which goes something like this.
Boom.
the question. Here's what we're debating, and I'm trying to, you know, this is important in our community because what I'm saying is this. You watch the people on TV, take the extremes, but they never get to the middle.
Let me get the hedge clippers out.
Get the hedge clippers.
I'm cutting the hedge down. We're going to go right to it.
Go to it.
HIPAA is probably our biggest issue in America, because here's what I'm saying. If you don't want to tell me about a physical ailment you have, I get it. There's no need for it. How does your physical ailment impact gun safety? Okay, I understand there's unique situations, but I'd rather have our federal law enforcement officials be able to have access to mental health records of our, not only everybody when you're assessing gun rights, applying for gun ownership, but also our teachers, our doctors, our nurses, our lawyers, our police force. If you have a mental health issue, no matter how small or how big, I think it needs to be reported.
Well, how would you feel having a general blanket, okay, this person does not qualify to purchase a weapon, versus giving the details of the specific mental health issue?
Well, I think there might be qualifying.
Unless they want to appeal it, and then it gets looked at.
I think there should be something set up to where there's an appealable process. So if I'm 22 years old, so I'm past that 21-year-old magic age. So I'm 22 years
about
old.
About my age.
Your age, 22, exactly. And I go and apply for, whether it's a handgun or a rifle, and I do the background screening, and there is a red flag, okay? A mental health issue that might be reported, okay? Or a criminal offense or something. I think if we have the integrated system and everybody's reporting to everybody throughout the United States, that person should be entitled to appeal. There'd be a brief hearing, an administrative hearing, to determine whether or not that red flag is justified to prohibit you from your Second Amendment rights to bear arms.
Well, can't that be kept confidential with a need-to-know type situation? Because I really do believe in privacy.
Well, I don't think that hearing should be public. I think there should be a private administrative hearing, because there's private and sensitive information that should be disclosed, and to determine whether or not that person has the mental capacity to handle a weapon. That's straightforward.
Yeah, pretty much. Another question that kind of leads into, guys, is maybe the details of the person's mental health is maintained, that privacy is maintained, but what about the fact that there was a hearing? Won't that be public record?
Who knows what the hearing was about?
You see, and here's my point. My view is, everybody plays a role in managing mental health. Everybody. So going back to what I was saying, you start with in family law. Everyone who touches a person, if you, Roger, have a mental health issue, who's going to know about it? People that work with you. People at home are going to know about it. People at your church are going to know about it. People at your gym are going to know about it.
How are they going to know about it?
Oh, different ways it manifests itself. In many instances, we're talking about privacy. The people that I know, a lot of them, are open about it and may say, you know, I'm bipolar. I have manic moments and depressed moments. And I use bipolar just because they are probably the most predominant out there. Someone who suffers from schizophrenia and they're on their medicines and same thing, managing it, are fine, but they are usually, in my experience, somewhat open about it. The ones we worry about are the ones who are either, they fall in one of two categories, undiagnosed, or today, unfortunately, don't have the money for the medicine, and they don't have insurance, and they're unidentified, or they don't have, and they're not actively managing it. Now, the case I told you.
For those in their circle of influence, they pretty much are suspecting there's something wrong with this guy.
Then here's what you can do. Let's say, Roger, let's take that scenario. That's why I said everybody plays a role. When the system breaks down, when the system breaks down, it's because you don't exist in a vacuum, Roger. That's my point. Neither does David, neither do I. There's a lot of people around
you. As much as I would really like to.
Well, you come as close as you can, sitting in here with the lights off in your little corner somewhere. Sometimes I don't even know you're in here.
Close the blinds.
He's got the blinds closed and the windows shut and the lights off. And then all of a sudden you see these eyes and he's moving.
That's not true.
But because of glare, looking at the screen. Only on certain days. But everyone has their eyes on you. And one thing we all do is we observe each other. And you know when something doesn't sound right or something seems odd. And usually, when I talk with you or then you engage that person, you can tell something is up. Now, like with my guy that I was using as an example, he's a very quiet, very, very quiet young man. Doesn't talk a lot, not involved in a lot of activities, community, yet. So then you say,
I say those are the dangerous ones.
Who would know? The family would know.
But Robert,
the family knew.
I think the bigger issue is, yes, we have undiagnosed people out there.
Yep.
We have friends and family who know the situation.
Sure.
We have the police or the school or the doctors who know the situation.
All who have a piece of the puzzle.
Okay. Let's wipe that out just for a second. Let's put that aside. We have a huge mental health issue in America, period. Correct?
1 in 7 is on some type of medication.
Let me ask you. How many people in America, and I don't know the answer, by the way, but how many people in America are teachers, educators, doctors and nurses, lawyers, mental health professionals themselves, or on the bench, or legislators who are actually prescribed medication for mental health issues?
I think you would be amazed to know the answer to that question because, as you were telling me, I can go down the list, and I don't know whether any of those particular professions has a higher than normal rate than the society at large, which is about 1 in 7.
And Roger asked me to add in radio show host.
Those are 7 out of 10, but yes.
But we have a huge issue, and if we aren't reporting, I don't know this because back when I was a teacher, I don't know if when I was applying, well, there was no psychological examination of me. I know when I went through
CIA
and the federal police officer program at FLETC, I know there's a psychological evaluation that I had to go through. And I tell you what, it was intensive. It was very intensive. When I was in the Marines, I went through the Marine Security Guard program. It was intensive. Because they had to know, what was your trigger point? You're caring. You're in control of a whole embassy. You're in charge, larger than charge. And we don't have those same protocols for everybody. And I think, and let's really jump ship here. Let's go to the Parkland issue. 2 weekends ago, and I have to say, I am proud to have been a part of the Vets for Vets on the Saturday a couple weeks ago. Where I was able to announce State Representative Cord Byrd. But we were talking at that presentation with Senator Rutherford and
Congressman.
John Rutherford and State Representative Cord Byrd about what do we do about school safety. And one of the things I brought up on Saturday was we have enough former military who are going through school, undergraduate, to become teachers. I think we should have a selective field or enhancement field to the education, kind of like a master's, to be able to have specific training for these people who volunteer to be part of the program and then cleared through mental health evaluations to make sure they're properly trained mentally and physically to be armed in the classrooms.
Sure.
And then these people would be part of an ISST. What's ISST? Inter-School Safety Team. And they're strategically put and placed in the schools, depending on the school size and the volume of the school.
I lied, and you told me that before, and yeah. I love that idea.
But I tell you what, I think if you have a weaning out and a filtering of the candidates who have mental health issues themselves, without HIPAA preclusions, you'd have a fine candidate. But if you just say, hey, let's arm our teachers, you might be having some candidates that apply to be armed who have mental health issues themselves.
No question. And part of that would be part of the selection process. But with your point, what's your trigger point? Everybody has a trigger point. And in today's environment, which is very, 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 life is stressful. My point is, and John Rutherford said this, there's tiers or layers to protection and you know, protecting schools and police and all that in general. I'm talking about mental health. We all play a role in managing mental health. Call us at 222-TALK, 222-TALK. You're listening to The Lawyer's Edge.
A law firm dedicated to helping families. A law firm dedicated to you. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
Hi, I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. For over 17 years, I've assisted the Jacksonville community by providing a full-service law firm for families, not the rich and powerful, but for everyday families like yours. Since 1998, I have handled some of the most complicated cases in Jacksonville, including Brenton Butler, and more recently, the jury verdict in Jermaine DeBose. Whether it's family law, including divorce, custody, or bankruptcy, juvenile law, personal injury, probate, civil rights, or not-for-profit and churches, I'm dedicated to helping your family with your legal needs. I'm Robert Slama, and I want to be your family's attorney. Call me anytime. My number is 904-296-1050, or you may text me at 838-8607. The law firm of Robert J. Slama.
It's our final segment of today's edition of The Lawyer's Edge. David Trotty, Robert J. Slama here with us today. We're talking about mental health, and I'm sure this probably stems from the problem down in South Florida and in Parkland, where someone who obviously seems to have been mentally unstable was able to go into a gun store and pass the background check, purchased an AR-15, and then shot up his former school, unfortunately took 17 lives.
Again, I really think that without some releasing of the HIPAA laws to the federal agencies or the state agencies who clear the gun permits and the ability to purchase arms, I just don't think that you're going to be able to filter out the persons who have mental health. And I'm a Second Amendment rights advocate. I love my right to bear arms. I'm a Marine, federal police officer. I don't want to give you the list of my arsenal, but I have some. But you know what? They're locked up. They're sitting away, firing pins away from the storage of the weapons. Never going to fire unless you find the firing pins. Okay? And you got to get the locks off and everything else. But more so, let's go to John Rutherford's, Congressman John Rutherford's tiering of the protection. I do not think, and I believe at Neptune Beach today we had a school resource officer assigned there, you know, kind of changing of the guards. Now we have resource officers at the elementary schools. It's a deterrent. It's a deterrent. Is it really a hardened target now? I don't think so. Being in the embassies and in the federal government, to have a hardened target, I really think you have to have not only a physical presence. I tell you, one person armed at a school of 400, 500, 600, 900 students is not a hardened target.
No.
There's too many entrances. I was at a school the other day as a guest speaker, and I went in as I'm going to the front office. One side of the school is locked down, but I look to the right, and you can just walk right down the halls.
And you have those, and I don't want schools to be a prison or to be a CO. Roger, we have a caller. Who do we have?
Russell, thank you for calling into The Lawyer's Edge. What's your comment or question?
Hi, guys. How are you this afternoon?
Great.
I really appreciate your comments on this topic, but I think it's worth pointing out, if I can, a couple of issues. One is that the reporting system as it is now is utterly and completely broken.
There really isn't one, is there?
Well, for example, the shooter in Aurora, Colorado, his psychiatrist reported him to local police as a danger to self, danger to others. They didn't follow up on it. He shot up a theater. In Parkland, right here in Florida, many, many times there were calls made. Nothing happened. I'm a fan of what you're saying in the sense of that we have to do a better job of reporting, but we've seen time and time again in these shooting cases that people were reported and nothing happened. Our police departments are overwhelmed. Our teachers and schools are overwhelmed. I'm not sure that we can create or fund a reporting system that will actually work.
I think there's kind of two aspects of the conversation. One is the reporting system, okay? And that is, hey, we have a person here who there's a concern, and we need to do something about it. We report that. And I really think in that situation, I'm reporting a possible situation, and I think the local police department or mental health professionals need to step in, whether it's through the court system under a Marshman's Act, through a Baker Act, or what have you. There you have, is there action or inaction? I think what I'm talking about is, where are the, if they're taking the legal channels to get the weapon, okay, I'm not talking about buying it off the street downtown at Pearl Street. I'm talking, if they're taking the legal steps to buy a weapon, and the mental health professionals or the police or the parents or whomever have reported a situation, there needs to be an integrated system to where when that gun shop owner files the application, that it is triggered that, hey, there's possible issues. And it doesn't mean that this person can't own a weapon. It means that there's a next step.
You mean, if I may interrupt, and this is what someone else had suggested. I think Israel does this. A flag goes in there, and then in some instances, some have talked about due process and then hearings, but others have said then you need a letter from your psychiatrist or someone to then psychologically clear you and say, yes, these four issues came up. I've looked at him. I've evaluated him. And yes, I say he's okay to have a weapon.
Which is something you probably buy.
The problem is how many psychologists are actually going to want to go, as I said, predicting human behavior, to go online knowing this person is buying a gun. And if you go ahead and clear him and say he's fine and something happens, you're looking at being sued or having problems. So you know what most doctors are going to default to.
Of course.
I can't clear him, so now the person loses their right to bear arms.
Then he has a path through the court system to protect the Second Amendment rights. No one, I don't think, well, I'm not trying to take anybody's Second Amendment rights away from them. But I think there has to be a clear path. It's just like I would not be able to be a federal police officer, past tense, if I had mental health issues. I don't think I'd be able to be a teacher in Florida
sure.
if I had certain issues. So there has to be a filtration system that is an integrated system from state to state, city to city, county to county, that is able to have all the information because, okay, I didn't get it in Florida, so I go to Utah and get it. Oh, can I get in Utah?
I absolutely agree, but I want to go back to something you said earlier. Before you became a law enforcement officer, you went through detailed psychological testing, correct?
That's right.
Because everybody has a breaking point.
They didn't find mine.
And of course, we make our law enforcement officers do this.
Boom!
And before we ever put them on the street, before we ever give them a weapon. Now, you seem very knowledgeable about this subject, so you'll know in an active shooter situation, what happens to the accuracy of a trained law enforcement officer?
Well, I think anybody, and again, it depends on the person who is handling the weapon. Okay,
on average.
On average, of course it's going to go down because you could fight or flight, and it all depends on, you know, we are trained use of force. And if you're in a group of let's just put it there, you're in a school and you're, let's say A Hall, and you've got 200 kids jam packed in an 8 foot wide by 50 foot long hallway, and you have a shooter, you know what? Unless that shooter is standing up by himself and everybody has hit the deck, you're probably not going to fire. In that situation,
a trained officer with lots of regular training will do that.
Absolutely, but that's what I was saying earlier. Is I don't think the answer is going to our current teachers, and I'm not saying they aren't qualified or somebody's not qualified more than others or whatever. I'm saying I don't think you just go and arm the teachers or the gym teachers or the assistant principals or the deans. I think you in our universities and our colleges is we identify certain people who are seeking an education degree that might have previous military or police experience, and we approach them or they approach us for wanting to be a part of a certain curriculum. And this curriculum is kind of like a master's degree, is in the protection and safety of our schools. They apply. They don't just get in. It's not like, hey, it's a candy store. I want to get in and I get the candy corn. It's you apply, but then you go under the same rigorous testing and training, not so much like as detailed as the FLETC up in Brunswick, Georgia, or JSO goes through here in Jacksonville. But you are trained to handle a firearm. Remember, these guys have previous experience, former military, former police officers, and they go into the system. And remember, our teachers here in Duke, I think in Jacksonville or in Florida, they only get an extra $1,000 a year to have a master's degree. So a compensation, something like that. But these guys are specifically trained from the previous careers in a certain curriculum how to handle these situations. And then they're...
And I would very much be in favor of that. And I'm both a teacher and a veteran.
And that's the conversation I think we need to steer this to. I do not – there's – I like the idea of arming teachers, but you know what? I see too many videos on the fake news book thing. I think it's called Facebook or Faceplant or whatever it's called, and where you see these videos of teachers being basically bombarded by students and overrun by the students. And we don't want to have a situation where we have a teacher who's afraid to use force for force. And I'm not talking about, hey, this kid's throwing a spitball at you, pull your nine out. They have to be trained in the levels of use of force. And if they aren't, then we have a situation. But I don't know why our classrooms are not situated with panic buttons.
Well, to give you an example, as I teach at a private school here in Jacksonville, and I'm not going to name names, but I was just asked to provide the classroom plan, my classroom plan, for what I would do with my class in the event of an active shooter.
That's one classroom, right?
Yeah, my classroom. What is my classroom going to do in the event of an active shooter?
Get down. And
I said, well, I'm not qualified to give this. I'm not a school security consultant. I'm not law enforcement. That should be a plan developed, you know, that way. But what I will say is this. Without what you're talking about, where people are specifically trained in a curriculum to deal with use of force issues, deal with these types of situations, just arming the teachers, just asking them to be that line of defense is as a teacher and as a veteran, I'm going to say it's madness.
No. Reckless.
I think borderline reckless. And you as a veteran, as a teacher, you understand probably where I'm coming from. I was in the embassy duty with Vienna, Austria, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And we had react drills. And we had these laminated sheets that were kind of in our post one, post two, whichever post you're at. And it was basically if you had an active shooter, a protest, a bomb threat, a hostage situation, a fire, a flood. We had all these different situations, and if something happened, these ISST personnel who are throughout the school would be in control of that zone with a specific react drill. And this is this is the healthy conversation that needs to take place. I don't think taking gun rights away from people. I do think a integrated reporting process needs to be integrated. I think loosening the restrictions on HIPAA for mental health issues needs to be part of it. But here's Robert. Russell, I thank you for your call.
And Robert, I think you're going to be heading up to Maggiano's.
I want to say real quick is I've been down to Parkland this past week. We gave them the banner. I've set up a scholarship fund on GoFundMe. Please go to GoFundMe and look up the scholarship fund in my name, Robert Slama, on behalf of the ROTC cadets. We're trying to raise money for the top cadet and to receive a scholarship. You can call us at the studio, but listen next week to The Lawyer's Edge.